Hello and welcome to Unbreak My Chart, the podcast that tapes the charts on a Sunday night, talks about it in the playground on a Monday morning. I'm Fraser McAlpine.
I'm Laura Snapes.
And welcome back, because this is the second of our podcasts, and it's gone rather well last week, hasn't it?
Yeah, everybody was incredibly nice. We seem to have had quite a lot of listeners from the stats that we can see, and we're also up now on iTunes, so please do subscribe there and leave us a nice review, maybe, if you feel like it.
One of the unexpected things that came out of releasing a podcast about the charts during a moment where the entire media of the country was focused on the charts is that you ended up doing special reports for BBC Radio 4's Front Row about the state of the charts all week last week, didn't you?
Yes, I think four nights out of five. Admittedly, I had to go on a crash course and learn an awful lot about how streaming works and also just listen to much more Ed Sheeran than I really ever hoped I would have. I thought that once I was done, you know, filing that review and talking about the charts last week, that would be it. But no, it's been a big Galway Girl week. Are we going to do the full rundown, Fraser? Should we start at 10?
So at number 10 is Dive by Ed Sheeran, which is the one I like, isn't it? This is the one I like.
Yes, and then we have number nine, What Do I Know, which is on its way up, which is the horrible fence-sitting non-political song, followed by at number eight, Supermarket Flowers, which is the one about a dying grandparent, which is terribly sad, and probably my favourite song on the record, that is also on its way up, whereas all of the other Sheeran songs in the top 10 are on their way down or stagnant. So number seven, there's Happier. Number six is the astonishing new man, who, in case you've forgotten, carries a man bag, but Ed Sheeran calls it a purse because he is very scathing. At number five is Perfect. At number four, up three, is the Chainsmokers and Coldplay, Something Just Like This, which I'm enjoying more and more every week.
It's a miraculous thing that we're now in a place where Chris Martin writes a song about being a superhero and it's sort of slightly self-effacing, but every week that his achievement becomes more and more heroic, and he's actually one of the few songs to go up in the face of the Ed Sheeran singularity. This is the song that we want to knock Shape of You and or Galway Girl, depending on what's at number one, off of the top slot, either next week or the week after.
I'm really enjoying your dog's ringing endorsement of that song as well. He's very pro Chainsmokers also.
Yeah, well, he wasn't barking when you were talking about Ed Sheeran earlier on.
Yeah, so now we're on to the top three, which is precisely the same as it was the week before. At number three, Castle on the Hill, the Radio 2 song. At number two, Galway Girl, the horrible Irish song.
Which was officially announced as being the single. I don't know if it's out now or it's properly a single now.
Does this mean we can look forward to a kind of a horrible video of him gambling on Galway Street?
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know why they didn't release the single on St. Patrick's Day on Friday with him head to toe in green with a, you know, leprechaun beard and, you know, all of that stuff.
Yeah, I think the leprechaun thing might be too on the nose.
There's no such thing as too on the nose with regards to Galway Girl. Well, or Galling Girl, as I've been taking to calling it.
God, yeah, that's very appropriate. I have to, admittedly, all the time I spent with the album, I never ventured into the bonus tracks because I just thought, this is pain, I can save myself. But there is actually a worse Irish song in the bonus tracks called Nancy Mulligan, which again is about his grandparents' young love. It sounds even more like The Cause. And I should say that I liked The Cause. They're the first band that I ever saw live, but it's a lot more trad and he really hasn't got the stones to pull it off. There is such, I mean, I've kind of joked with Galway Girl about how on the nose all the kind of Irish stereotypes are in it, and jokes about how he might write a similar song about girls from all different kind of countries. There are actually many songs like that in the bonus tracks. There's one about a girl from Barcelona, where I think he rhymes Barcelona and Catalonia, and I think there's one about a girl from Ghana. He's really going for all demographics here. I mean, well done. This is purely shameless. And then number one, still a non-mover at 10 weeks in the chart, is Shape of You. Drake got 15 weeks at number one last year, almost beating Bryan Adams' record of 16 weeks at number one. Do you reckon Shape of You is going to do it?
No, but because of Galway Girl. I think Galway Girl was, I mean, I have young teenage children in my house. They immediately, on hearing the Ed Sheeran album, latched onto Galway Girl.
Really?
And played it Yeah, over and over and over and over and over and over and over. It's the one. So it's the song I knew best off of the album before I'd even really had a chance to listen to it properly. And I think that's why the song is the one that's been singled out. It's not. I know it seems like cynical marketing to put it out for St. Patrick's Day, but I think there is something in that noise which is so different to the rest of the Ed Sheeran output that and it's got that thing that it needs to have to guarantee attention. So I think in a couple of weeks, Shape of You will be knocked off the number one spot by Galway Girl.
Admittedly, I only need to read the words Galway Girl to get the whole song stuck in my head. So yeah, I think he's definitely tapped into that slightly kind of evil, insidious vein of pop culture, much like Disney's Frozen, where it just has some kind of psychological effect that you can't quite unpick and you don't know how it works, but you've seen it with your own eyes, kind of deactivating children and just like turning them into, you know, willing supplicants to what you've just put them in front of. So yeah, he's definitely, there's some kind of weird DNA encoded in that song.
You heard it here first. Laura Snape said that Frozen was evil.
Well, I'm only saying...
definitely what you just did.
I watched it with my cousin, who is just over one, and, you know, like, can't speak or anything like that, can't really express, like, a preference for what her favourite things are. We'd been watching regular kids' TV, and she was, like, just, you know, playing around, having a good time, but then I put Frozen on, and she was just docile. She just sat in my lap and didn't move for the duration, and it was weird.
I have that with In the Night Garden does exactly the same thing, but I think In the Night Garden also contains, it's got two messages. It's got messages for the young children, which is, you know, stop, just stare and watch and open eyes, shut mouth, quiet now. But for grown-ups, it's like, you are about to fall asleep. Mm-hmm. You will fall asleep now. And it's incredibly soporific. But the weird thing about In the Night Garden, sorry, this is completely off track, but the weird thing about In the Night Garden is there's an incredible melancholy that happens right at the very end where they do the goodbye bit and Iggle Piggle goes off. And for some reason, just at the bit that the music starts, every single time I feel this welling in my chest of like, oh, it's like something awful's happening. Like, you're never going to see the Night Garden ever again.
Just bringing it back around to Ed Sheeran, he has not yet induced that feeling with me. Whenever I hear the end of one of his songs, I think good night and good riddance. But yes, at number one, we have Shape of You, and that's not going anywhere. So that's it. We're done with Sheeran this week. 2 weeks into our own podcast, we are breaking the rules immediately.
Yes, we had an email, didn't we? We've had a nice email.
From Eleanor Chalkley. The subject line is Busting Sheeran's Grim Hegemony. Hegemony? I never know how you say that.
No, I don't know.
She says, hello, Laura and Fraser. I too used to give a damn about the charts. The stack of mid-90s index cards charting the torrid throes of Britpop says that maybe I gave too much of a damn. That's amazing. But I too feel like there's something very wrong with the current formulation. Because I'm one of those dreadful Eurovision people, I basically haven't listened to any UK chart radio since Christmas. The only records to have made it through my glittery filter bubble have been Any More by Goldfrapp, Hang Me Out to Dry by Metronomy and Robin, and Scared of the Dark by Steps. All of these are existing artists who can get my attention by trading on existing fan love. What about all the new acts who can't get me to do that first listen on Spotify? I love the streaming infrastructure because it allows me to really explore the outer fringes of pop, but on an industry-wide scale, there's just so much, so bloody much of it that in the end, the same stuff comes to the top of the pile. Is there a way out of this that doesn't involve the word curation?
Well, there is. I mean, the two things that come out from that, from my point of view, is we do this thing at the end of the podcast, and we will continue to do it, where we will nominate a track that would have been our own personal streaming number one for that week. And so, knowing that I had to do this week, I went into Spotify's new releases section and just played all of the songs, because if they're new, I'm working on the premise. Now, I know this is a curated list to an extent, because not every track that comes out in a week will appear in that list, but I did go through it and I did earmark the things that I liked, and one of them is by a band that I hadn't heard of before, and it will actually later on in the podcast will appear to be my sort of track of the week. And so I think there's an element of that where it is just, it's personal sifting. But and if the thing with curation is, if you think about what radio stations do, that's all they do is that kind of curation. They'll pull together playlists of stuff, and sometimes it will be because it's already been popular in the clubs or something like that. But actually, it's also, there's an element of producer's taste, or, you know, playlist maker's taste. But the other thing that we did this week particularly is that we've already broken the chart down and made it again in our own image. Because of the conversations last week, there was a very good article that Mark Savage of BBC News wrote about how the charts could be rejigged so that the Ed Sheeran singularity can't happen again, and a few other things, and obviously, you know, the research that you've done for Front Row as well. And it seems to me the most straightforward thing to do is to it's just to nail back down the difference between singles and albums. And one of the ways we could do that is to introduce YouTube streaming figures into the chart, so that when bands or artists are releasing lyric videos and then following them up with a proper video, that will, you know, effectively, because the amount of people who are streaming off of YouTube is so huge, that will effectively push singles away from albums in terms of how many streams are being listened to.
Saying that, every song off the Ed Sheeran album is uploaded to his official YouTube account. But yes, I think this could work.
Because also, because I did look at the Ed Sheeran thing just to double check my own rationale with that. Every single song has a lyric video or just an image that with the song that comes with it, video. But the singles have videos as well. So there's twice as many. If you could combine the two streaming figures, then it would effectively double, and it would lift those songs up higher and all of that. So it's not foolproof, because there isn't a foolproof way of doing that, so that you can include these strange moments when everybody starts listening to one song all at the same time. What we've done is recategorize the top 40 as if Ed Sheeran's songs from the album count as a song. Well, the songs that are from the album are album songs and therefore belong in the album chart. We've made Shape of You and Castle on the Hill into a double A side because it was effectively released on the same day. And we've allowed that Galway Girl is the next single. So this is the top 10 adjusted for the Sheeran singularity.
So in at number 10 in our charts is Ciao Adios by Anne-Marie, which it's definitely something that's made in like a post-Rihanna, post-Sia kind of vein. I always slightly wonder how cool it is that you've got like an Essex girl basically singing in like a Jamaican accent. But, you know, that's the sound of pop now, so I think it's a bit too late for me to kind of object to it. I did really like this. I thought that, like the Selena Gomez and Kygo song that we're going to get onto, she did some very exciting, like, piercing things with her voice in the chorus. It doesn't quite go where you think it's going to go.
No, it's an interesting song to have in, I know it's in our personal top 10, but it's interesting to have it there, having just discussed how new artists are struggling to make their name. I don't think that they are particularly. I mean, this will come on to this with some of the other people in our top 10, but there are lots of artists that you would qualify as being relatively new or new that are doing really well in the singles top 10. I think part of the issue is that the singles top 10 is no longer a benchmark of what everybody is talking about in popular music.
Although the one thing that I would say about Anne-Marie is, yeah, I think she's very good at what she does and she's got an exciting voice, but I would say this is one of about four songs in the top 10 that all sound incredibly similar. Spotify might be, you know, streaming might be allowing like a certain amount of new artists to break through, but they're new artists who are definitely in an incredibly similar vein to each other. I kind of feel like the way things work at the moment is when you look at the major pop artists, those people who really want to be at the top of their game, they're always pulling from the underground and trying to bring underground ideas into their music and then transform them into on the massive platform. Whereas I think these kind of more mid-level people like Anne-Marie and others we're going to get onto, the assured path to success for them is to replicate an already established sound. While they're good songs, there's not a lot of innovation there.
I think that's a fair comment. I think that's about right. And there'll be a point, if she is to continue to have a longer career, where she'll have to jump from one mode of operation to the other and become one of those people that that jumps ahead and looks to what is coming up from the underground rather than what's currently popular. And maybe she won't. So we shall have to wait and see.
So at number 9 in our charts is Calvin Harris and Slide, which also features Frank Ocean and Migos.
Slide on all your nights like this. Do you try on all your nights like this? Put some spotlight on the side. Whatever comes.
So that was Slide by Calvin Harris. I can't remember really when it started, but I feel like for the past 3 or 4 years, everybody's been really, really obsessed with defining what the song of the summer is going to be. And usually it's a conversation that starts around May, June, and then people are kind of weighing it up all summer. Sometimes you have a conclusive answer. Like last summer, I think you could definitively say it was One Dance by Drake. Other years, it's not quite so clear. But I think that's kind of part of pop's general arms race now. And I can see this race starting a lot easier with the release of a song like this, which... Again, with the Frank Ocean thing on it, it reminds me of kind of the Kendrick Lamar duality, where Kendrick Lamar's solo stuff is really artistic and very meaningful, and it's got a great message to it. But you could listen to that and you could have absolutely no idea about the kind of slightly cheesier pop stuff that he does.
Yeah.
You could purely listen to him guessing on a Taylor Swift track and not really know anything about his albums like Good Kid, Mad City. And I feel like this is Frank Ocean doing a similar thing. People who might never engage with Endless and Blonde might only hear him in the context of this Calvin Harris song, which he definitely brings a lot of class to. I think if you strip... Like, Frank Ocean's song to me is like, it's so weighty and it's so kind of classy and velvety. But if you take him away from this song, you could very easily imagine Will Smith rapping over it in 1997. It's really cheesy.
Do you know, all the way through, while we were just talking about that, I was thinking quietly to myself, who is it that is giving the seal of approval to whom in this instance? Because Calvin Harris, a proven hitmaker, he has, you know, his work with Rihanna is amazing. He's done, you know, this is not a man who is uncool. In some respects, and Frank Ocean has all of the critical reverence that you could possibly hope for. And then you mentioned Will Smith, and I was like, oh, no, I know now. It's all right. I can tell.
But I never understand. One thing I always really fail to get my head around is when incredibly rich people do things that are really trashy, presumably only to get more rich. For example, earlier today I was talking about why Sarah Jessica Parker would sign up to do a third Sex and the City film when she's clearly a woman of taste, and those films are the opposite of taste, having seen both of them a number of times. And somebody like Frank Ocean, super classy, one of the most respected artists in the world, like at the top of his game, he doesn't need to be on a Calvin Harris song. I mean, being on a Calvin Harris song isn't doing anything for him artistically. It's probably opening him up to a different audience, but like I was saying, they're not necessarily a crossover audience. And you just think, what's your end game here? Why do you want to do this? Maybe he just really liked the beat. Maybe he just likes this slightly cheesy Will Smith beat.
There's something to be said for saturation. I mean, I was young in the 1970s, and my memories of David Bowie are confusing because I remember really clearly the Bing Crosby duet. And I'd never offended me at all. I always thought it was perfectly fine. It was just part of the crazy stuff that he'd done. And they would play quite regularly on Radio 1. They used to play the Laughing Gnome as being a song by David Bowie that would sit alongside all of the other songs by David Bowie, which are all, you know, impeccably cool and have all the credibility in the world. But because I grew up with all that stuff, you just don't think about it in the same way that, you know, I also grew up not minding that Paul McCartney did the Frog Chorus, because it doesn't matter. And so there's not that I'm saying that this is the equivalent of the Frog Chorus for Frank Ocean, or am I not? I mean, it's perfectly fine in a sense just to do stuff. So number eight, while we're talking about people doing cheesy stuff and not knowing who is bringing credibility to whom, we've got It Ain't Me by Kygo and Selena Gomez. Where you been, where you going? But I know I won't be home and you'll be on your own.
So that was Selena Gomez and Kygo and It Ain't Me. With this one, who's bringing credibility to who? I don't know if it's so much a matter of credibility as almost like a soft relaunch for Selena Gomez, because I think she's been off for a little while. I think she's maybe she's got like an autoimmune disease or something, and I think she's spoken quite frankly about her mental health as well, and this seems like a very high profile way, admittedly, of kind of easing back into the public eye. My favourite lyric in it is when she talks about all the great nights she spent with a former beau, maybe Justin Bieber. A part of their relationship that entailed summer nights and the libertines. I really like the idea of Selena Gomez, who you got her start on the Disney Channel, listening to the libertines. She probably would have been about 7 at the time. You wonder where this lyric has come from, whether she genuinely is a fan of Pete Doherty and Carborat, or whether it just rhymed. I found that very bizarre.
Well, people can go back and listen to stuff. They don't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be current. Name-dropping the Libertines.
No, that's true, but just something about kind of the, you know, the everybody knows what the culture of the Libertines is, and it seems like a far cry from anything that Selena Gomez is into or represents. I like the idea that she might be just kind of honestly, not confessing, because that's kind of implies shame in it, but she might just be honestly owning up to the fact that a great part of her relationship with Justin Bieber was soundtracked by the Libertines, like every teenager in Camden in 2002.
Banging out "Can't Stand Me Now" and "Music When the Lights Go Out" while they're being two of the most famous squeaky clean pop stars in the whole world.
Timeless song. I think "Can't Stand Me Now" is the only song I could still play. Oh no. "Don't Look Back Into the Sun" is the only song I could still play on acoustic guitar, which I will never do. I'd just like to make that promise publicly now.
Okay, well, I'd like to make another promise publicly now. When this chart, this podcast reaches 1 million listeners, that's what we're going to get Laura to do. So tell your friends.
There's an incentive. So let's keep going up our fake charts. At number 7 is Jack Jones featuring Ray and "You Don't Know Me." "No, I'm just passing. Do you want to drink? Nah, thanks for asking. Ooh, nah, nah, yeah. Don't act like you know me, nah, nah, yeah. I am not your homie, not your homie. Ooh, nah, nah, yeah. So that was Jack Jones featuring Ray and "You Don't Know Me." I really have very little to say about that song. It reminds me of something that might have been written at a songwriting camp for Rihanna before she came out with "Anti" and established herself as more of kind of a serious songwriterly artist. There's nothing wrong with it. It really just reminds me of going to gym classes and lifting weights and sweating quite a lot.
It's a perfectly utilitarian piece of music that does exactly what it's supposed to do. Moving on. At number 6 is "Human" by Rag & Bone Man. Some people got the real problems. Some people like to love. Some people think I can solve them. Love with gimmick and image and all that kind of stuff. And his presentation is that this is a credible artist with a bluesy kind of voice. But in order to get to where he is now, he's had to have the artificial leg up of winning a presumptive award that says you're going to be big. And here you are, big. And the only reason we're talking about the fact that you are big is because we said you were going to be big, and here you are, you're big. So it's a very odd form. Again, if we're going to discuss credibility, what does that say? What, you know, that's that weird sleight of hand that happens with pop a lot, where you know, the thing that you're selling, and it happens to an extent, it happened with Adele, although I think she was slightly more grassroots, and definitely happened with Ed Sheeran. What you're selling is this credibility, my raw talent is what has seen me through. But actually, it's often the little artificial leg ups here and there that are more telling to get people's attention in the first place. And then after that, you can, you know, you can allow your talent to speak on your behalf as much as you like.
Well, if anybody who watched the Brits knows, he's not very good at letting anything speak on his behalf. He gave two of the most mealy-mouthed non-interviews I've ever seen, and he's just won two gigantic awards. But yeah, it's interesting what you're saying about that kind of...
Which he knew he was going to win.
I know, he didn't even prepare a speech. The ultimate in "Will This Do?" It's interesting the way that you talk about his success is preconceived. He's somebody who very much benefits from a record label established narrative of throwaway pop and then quote-unquote real music. He's got the big booming voice. He's got kind of a slave gang rhythm going on. He's very earnest and earthy, and
clearly not selling his music based on his looks either. And I'm sorry, but that does help to get that across. It's like, well, clearly this isn't some fly by night sex object man, because he's just got this talent. Yeah, it's undeniable. Yeah, that element to it. And you know, I'm not saying that he isn't a talented singer, but it is that kind of something about that is kind of deadening, I think. They're just like, oh, can't we just have some fun, please?
Yeah, he's got the kind of voice that reminds me of two things. One, X Factor auditions, when people walk out on stage and nobody's expecting very much, but everybody's blown away and on their feet within about three lines, and Simon Cowell is raising like one impressed eyebrow.
He's the man, Susan Boyle, isn't he? He's the man, Susan Boyle.
But then the other thing that he reminds me of, which ties him in with Ed Sheeran, is one of our mutual specialist subjects, the kind of artist who does incredibly well playing beach bars in Cornwall in the summer. If I was an A&R man, I would be booking my Airbnb for Perrenporth for May, June, July, and I'd be going to the Watering Hole and up to the Blue Bar, and... because that seems to be the crucible of pop talent at the moment.
Absolutely. Who can play Sweet Home Alabama the best? And then you've got your record deal for life.
Most of the songs in our fake top 10, I don't really mind that much, but I would say this is the only one that I actively loathe. I hate the sound of it. I really don't like him as a figure and all the kind of like quote-unquote authenticity real music that he stands for. I hate the lyrics to it, just that kind of like individualist, like me or lump me, I make mistakes and there's nothing I can do about it. It's just, it's a shrug delivered in a very muscular kind of way, and it drives me nuts.
It's the artificial pumping up, isn't it? It's full of hot air. Let's leave, you know, we don't have to talk about him anymore. Let's leave him behind and move on to number 5, which is our big tip from last week as being a high entry. So we're already looking prescient and intelligent. Solo Dance by Martin Jensen.
Was Solo Dance by Martin Jensen, and I think it actually ties in with the song that is at number 4 in our fake chart, Katy Perry's Chained to the Rhythm, in that they are both songs about how irresistible it is to get out on the dance floor, neither of which do a particularly good job of actually making you want to go and do that thing. I think Martin Jensen's song also suffers from the fact that its name sounds like a corporate reimagining of Robin's Dancing on My Own, categorically the best song about dancing on one's own, and calling it Solo Dance just really kind of conveys the general lack of enthusiasm in this song. I did think it would sound very good as a polyphonic ringtone, but that's the only good thing I've got to say about it.
I love that idea that this is some kind of, let's sum up Dancing on My Own, but just really quickly because I haven't got a lot of time, and let's face it, that horrible man who did the cover version of that earlier this year is still around. So, you know, Solo Dance. Yeah, Solo Dance. I think that's that's entertained me no end. Yeah, the Katy Perry song has a similar problem, doesn't it? And I heard a mix today by Hot Chip of the Katy Perry song, which it's all right. It's okay. Like, it's still a bit slow. And I think there's a weirdness about that, that there is for her to bang on and on and on quite so incessantly about how you can't avoid dancing to a rhythm. Over a rhythm that is not, is perfectly possible to avoid dancing to, is weird. And they've done stuff to try and zhuzh it up a little bit, but I don't know. I don't know. If that song was about literally anything else, it would be loads better.
I will say, I think objectively, it's not a good song, but every time I hear, and especially the mangled syllables in the chorus where she says zombie, that really, really bothers me. But I have to say, every time I hear it out in the wild, like on the radio, I do find myself just like bobbing on, being like, oh yeah, what's this again? I quite like it. Oh, it's that Katy Perry song. So she's definitely got something here. But I'm looking forward to the rest of the album, see how her purposeful pop, as she's branded it, pans out. But yeah, this is not a wildly exciting comeback.
Okay, so our top 3 is kind of predictable, bearing in mind what's in the actual top 10. So at number 3, it's Something Like This by Shapeshifters and Coldplay, which we've discussed before. Number 2 is Galway Girl by Ed Sheeran, and at number 1, the double A side, Shape of You and Castle on the Hill by Ed Sheeran. And I think we've said enough about Ed Sheeran now. I think we can move on. Some of the interesting things that happened, though, even in our seasonally adjusted top 40, is that Scale of the Dark by Steps, which I think you and I are fairly agreement was a good idea, is a good song. And the email that we had in from Ellie also said it was, you know, seemed to imply that it's a good song. Only got to number 23 in our chart and number 37 in the real chart, which is odd, isn't it? And I don't even know if that counts as a failure anymore, because Steps are now a heritage act. Because they're touring with the Venger Boys and, you know, they're back and all of that. So even though they're releasing a song which is exactly what they used to do, I described it on a Facebook post to someone who'd been sniffy about it as being the Force Awakens of Step songs, in that it completely it does everything that everybody wants from that franchise again, only, you know, in a way that makes it feel slightly modern, but it is... It reminds you of how much you used to like what they used to do when they used to do it before. It's an analogy that makes no sense to anybody who's not into Star Wars, but it really works.
I wouldn't see it as a failure either, because I think, as is the way of things at the moment, they enter really low and then they shoot up. Like, there's loads of Little Mix songs that are on their way up the charts this week, and so I think Steps is only going to rise. I think it's a very respectable comeback. And also, I'm sure I read some briefly skimmed past on Twitter some chat about them maybe being Britain's Eurovision entry, which I think would literally make them into like national treasures straight away overnight. The first time we've ever had like a running chance at Eurovision in years, a band actually willing to slightly put their neck on the line and be like, yep, we're going to do this. We're not just going to let some bland, failed CBBC presenter wannabes like do a terrible ballad.
Yeah, that would be amazing. If they went in there with the full ABBA doing dance music step song, even if we lost badly, you'd be like, well, look, clearly this is a European friendly sound. Clearly this is the kind of thing Eurovision revels in. Clearly then we can only go away from this failure feeling that this is personal because of Brexit or whatever, rather than it being on the strength of music. Whereas now, and for the last, I don't know, always, the songs that we field are so uniformly poor and deliberately, it always feels like, ha ha ha, it's just Eurovision, we're not even going to really try because it's just Eurovision, is the most insulting way to go into a competition. And then to have the nerve to get angry afterwards because we didn't win, it's like, oh, come on.
Yeah, it's that kid who goes into an exam and is like, didn't even revise, yeah? And he's like, gosh, everybody else has had to try really hard.
And look, they've all got better marks than you. Isn't that a shock? The other song we were was going to mention as maybe, might also creep back up the charts over the following weeks. Lord's Green Light on our chart gets to number 20, but in the real chart is at number 34. And again, but I would have thought that would have been higher because that has had an enormous push from the videos that went out from her performance on Saturday Night Live, and just generally, she's incredibly well thought of. I would have thought something.
Yeah, it's on the Radio 1 A-list.
Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it? And that's not... And again, it's the song that should be a hit. Greenlight is not a song that is disappointing as a return from an artist that people already like.
No, I won't mention it as my favourite, my most played song of the week, even though it was, because I think I had a Lord song last week as well. But yeah, clearly my like daily Spotify streams of it have not been adding up to quite enough. I think with that, even though the video for it is amazing, it feels like she needs to do some kind of big in-person thing in the UK for it to actually take off. There'll be like a TV performance or something like that that will send it back up the charts again, because I think she's a very good visual pop star, and maybe it hasn't quite had the chance that it needs yet.
Well, one hopes music would be enough. You know, maybe she's going to have a massive Twitter fight with Piers Morgan or something, and that'll lift it. But it's a shame. It feels a shame. Come on, everyone, do better.
There are some possible tracks that might make it into the real chart or our fake chart next week if we're forced by Ed Sheeran to do another one. First, the one that I think is the most interesting is Muramasa and Charlie XCX and One Night. Let's listen to a little bit of that. It was only one night, but I wanna go back to where we were. I just wanna go back to where we were. I just wanna go back to where we were. It was only one night, but I wanna go back to where we were. I just wanna go back to where we were. Fraser, what do you make of Muramasa and Charlie XCX?
Well, I like it, but I think it lacks the Charlie... Well, I think the problem with Charlie XCX, or the problem that she has, is that she feels most unique when she's doing the thing that she's actually gifted out to other artists. So when she's doing that bratty thing, you know, that I love it and all of that, it's like, oh, this is a fresh voice. It's a you know... A shouty voice. It's great. And then the other stuff, although there's loads of it and of extraordinarily high quality, a lot of it, it doesn't necessarily cut through as something that has a great deal of personality and character. There is a lot of, I think there's quite a lot of music around at the moment that has a similar strain to this. So while I liked it, I wouldn't necessarily have picked it out of a lineup and said, oh, this is special. This will definitely be the thing that, you know, pushes her back into public consciousness. And I think there's that weird push and pull with her releases where, you know, she struggled to get a mixtape out earlier, was it towards the end of last year or earlier this year?
Her album's been pushed back, which has been the story of most of her albums, I think. This feels slightly like, because the record, they released a single after the After Party, which seemed to bomb initially, and then actually started climbing the charts a little bit. I think it was actually on also a Disney Channel advert. I don't know how much that helped it or what she might have made of that. And so then it was kind of more of a surprising hit. And then they said that the album, which I think was meant to be due out this month, was actually going back to later in the year. And yeah, then she wanted to just put out this mixtape because she's somebody who's incredibly prolific. And her, she's so much more interested, I think, in the craft of writing pop songs than actually having to go and be the face of them and be the pop star. I think she once cancelled what would have been her biggest tour because she thought, I've got to actually get back in the studio. I've got too much I want to write to be kind of dancing around and singing these songs every night. But yeah, she does really seem caught between that, like, the production world and the actual pop star world. And I don't really know anything about the origins of this song, but I wonder if it might be her label saying, if we do this, it will get you in the charts and your name will be around and it will be a good springboard for you to be like, ta-da, I've got this great album. And I've heard bits of it and it's really, really good. But yeah, I always feel a bit sorry for her that the narrative around her constantly, sort of like Carly Rae Jepsen on the last album, is always just people saying, why isn't this quite working? Because all of the signifiers of it being good are there, the songs are there, they're very outspoken, they seem really exciting, but something just quite isn't gelling with it.
Yeah, and it's,
and that must be incredibly frustrating for her.
Of course. But I guess this is where pop music will always struggle, because the metric for quality is only success. And rock music doesn't have to deal with this stuff. Rock music can just be good or not good, or people, you know, people like, or often will be more affectionate, feel more affectionate towards an album that hasn't sold terrifically well or even made a big impact with the public, but it's, you know, it hits you on an individual level quite hard. And I think with pop music, you know, it's all or nothing, and an artist like Charlie XCX, who isn't Rihanna or Katy Perry or Beyonce level, but has the some of the raw ingredients that could push her in that direction, whether she wants to go there or not, is always going to be measured by whether she's hitting those high notes. You know, are you in the club? Are you succeeding? And in a way, it seems a shame, because actually, you know, the fact that she's an interesting enough songwriter and a compelling enough performer. I don't know if you saw any of her performances from, I think, last year's Glastonbury. She brings out all of the inflatable stuff and the massive props and all of that. So there's a lot of thought that goes into, for somebody that wants to be in the studio, she's putting on the show. But yeah, it's harder for someone in the pop field to break through and achieve a success level if they're not actually charting, you know, in the real top tier level, which is in some ways it seems a little bit unfair.
Yeah, sometimes I wouldn't necessarily listen to all of her music like for fun at home, but also I don't really listen to it in the kind of situations that she intends it for. But I sometimes wonder if she's hamstrung by the fact that everything she does is very high concept. She's a really, really intelligent thinker about pop and everything that she's trying to achieve, but she talks about her work in a really, really high concept way. And I think to people who don't follow pop in that kind of like music criticism way, might just listen to it and think, well, what actually differentiates this from the Anne Marie song? And yeah.
Well, and actually that leads us quite neatly onto one of the other songs that probably will do, will probably be appearing in the charts, hours or otherwise, over the next few weeks.
Kasabian. You want to say the title
because
of this
song, it's amazing. You're in love with a psycho!
It's very EastEnders script. I used to, well, when Kasabian first came out, I really, really liked them. I had their album. I thought they were great. In the interim years, I really hated them. I thought they stood for everything that I'm not interested in, that kind of like laddie, boozy, real music kind of thing. But within the last few albums, I sort of come back around to them. I wouldn't ever listen to them, but I kind of admire how enduringly silly they are. And although they still say things like, yeah, we're going to get guitar music back in the charts, good luck with that. The only person getting guitar music in the charts is Ed Sheeran.
And also, I mean, that's part of their silliness, though, because there aren't guitars on their records. There aren't. Listen to the actual music that they make. No guitars. It's a common thread. Serj from Kasabian is the least loud guitarist in the whole history of rock and roll music. He's like the anti-Jimmy Page. He stands up there with his nice Rickenbacker guitar, and he plays it with his hands, and the sound of synthesizers comes out. Time and again, they've got a man playing lead guitar for them in Kasabian, and even he isn't very loud. So no, the idea that they are guitar music is not borne out by the sonic noise that they create.
Also, this song just sounds like Blondie's Heart of Glass, kind of remade in a way that slightly drunk men could dance to at a wedding. If you listen to the little synth part in it, it's exactly like Heart of Glass. Also, I mean, their lyrics are kind of brilliantly ridiculous. Who can forget? What was it about? Horse meat in the burgers, policemen doing murders or something like that, which is a great lyric. On this song, there is one about jibber jabber at the bargain booze and reciting Charles Bukowski, I got nothing to lose, which I enjoyed. But then also it contains what I suspect might be one of the least appealing sexual metaphors I have ever come across, which is taste of macaroni on a seafood stick. And I don't know if my warped brain is interpreting that as something sexy when it's not, but that is disgusting.
I couldn't pass that even in my head as to being... Yeah, I sort of, yeah, I mean, shape, flavour, yes, I get it. Wow, you heard that, because I didn't, that completely passed me by. To be fair, I have been slightly overwhelmed by the fact that there is a song that is called You're In Love With A Psycho, that doesn't sound like it's a song called You're In Love With A Psycho. And Kasabian have done songs that sound like they should be called You're In Love With A Psycho before. It's just, this isn't it. This is a song that's not, it's in the same vein as Where Did All the Love Go, that one. And it's not, you know, like Bumblebees or, because I like them when they are at their absolute, as you say, silly, thuggish, cartoonish best. That's when I really like Kasabian. And I had such high hopes for this song when I saw the title. And, you know, in proper rock critic style, I find myself disappointed.
Maybe they can rescue it by getting Danny Dyer in the video.
I think you have to.
That would redeem it.
And just have him shout, "You're in love with a psycho," over and over again, and not put the song in. That would be great.
So Fraser, even though we've already wildly fabricated the charts this week, what would be number one in your personal most streamed?
Well, this is what I was listening to. There were two songs that really stuck out this week for me on my trawl through the new releases section of Spotify. And one was the song Fantasy Island by The Shins. Well, I never really particularly liked The Shins before. They hadn't hit me before, but they're a bit old man indie. And I did do Jens Ekman last week. So the most streamed track is a song called No Matter by a French duo called Basic Tape. And it sounds a bit like this. Where you are, where you're coming from, put your hand on your heart, don't wear. Yeah, you know that I, we, me, us, we're doing it all the same. No matter where you are, where you're coming from, put your hand on your heart, don't wear. That was No Matter by Basic Tape, which is probably the song I've listened to most in the last 7 days. There's just, even though it contains within it the basic musical ideas of most of the rest of the songs in the top 40, there's just something enormously appealing about the way that it works as a song. The chorus has the kind of harmony backing and big lift that you want from a pop song that makes you slightly worried that you're either going to burst into tears of joy or, you know, just grin inanely. It's got that thing that pop music should do, which is pick you up by the back of the neck and lift you slightly upwards. It's not perfect, you know, there's things that are that you know, that because it sounds ever so slightly generic, I could easily see why people would pass it by. Something, you know, in a list of songs, some of which sound really similar, that's something in it really sort of stuck in my head, and that's all you can ask for, really.
I think at this juncture you have to reveal the number one pop song that makes you cry involuntarily, that one might not imagine would make somebody cry. The Ting Tings, That's Not My Name.
Oh, yes. It's partly to do with the fact that I first heard the song at a period where I felt like I was slightly struggling for my identity and that people were viewing me in a way that wasn't true. But that song hit me really, really hard. And I also really like it when songs develop themes and then at the end of the song they just put all the themes together in a big pile, which is what happens in that there's all these different bits that interlock. And then there's a bit where the beat, which has been that kind of jerky My Sharona type beat all the way through the song, suddenly becomes proper 4 to the 4, and the whole song just seems to shudder and then lift off the ground. And it's at that point, especially when they're doing it live, it's at that point that the tears just come unbidden pouring down my face.
I have a similar confession. When I was 18, I had been to one university for 5 weeks and then quit because I didn't really like it. And I'd applied to a number of other universities. And there was one that I wasn't that bothered about getting into, but I found out that I had been rejected from it while I was working in a cafe in Truro. And that was fine. I wasn't particularly bothered about the news that I'd been rejected. But then Scouting for Girls, I Wish It Was Me You Chose, or whatever it was called, came on the radio. And it made me involuntarily...
Elvis Ain't Dead.
It made me involuntarily weep so much that I had to run and hide in the public toilets across the road for 10 minutes in case anybody heard me crying in the cafe toilet.
You see, I have strong feelings about that section of that song as being... I mean, it's the really frustrating thing about Scouting for Girls is that a lot of what they do is horrible. But every now and again, and for their run of hit singles, there seemed to be one section in each song which was like, oh, that's really good. Oh, and you're repeating it, I see. But yes, that little melodic refrain and the way that he, you know, the words, it's a perfect union of emotion and words and melody. And it will get you like that.
So my most streamed song this week, apart from Lord, which I'm discounting because it was also my most streamed song last week, is a song called Macabre, also by a French pop star called Jane, which is spelled J-A-I-N. Let's listen to some of that. So Jane released her debut album in France at the end of 2015, and she's getting a bit of a push over here now. I saw her play in France the other day for something that I'm writing, and it was extraordinary. It was one of the most exciting pop gigs on like a small level that I've seen in a really, really long time. Everybody was going bananas. She's got this great look where she wears like a traditional kind of white French collar on top of a black jumper or whatever. And there were lots of little kids in the audience dressed up like her, which I thought was very sweet. But she grew up... She lived in France for a bit, but then she grew up between Abu Dhabi and Dubai and the Congo. And so she picked up all of her musical education was kind of experience in these countries. I think there might be some people who might get a bit cultural appropriation about it, but I interviewed her and that seemed to be her genuine experience, kind of discovering rap music and local music in the backyard of a local producer in the Congo. And I think this is a great song. She said she made it because she couldn't believe that hardly any young people knew who Miriam Makeba was, so she wanted to celebrate her in a pop song. I think it's a great example of a lyric which is based around bending a word in shapes that it totally shouldn't fit in, Macabre, the way she uses it in the chorus, and it turns it into something totally different. I think it's great.
And it isn't a song about going to the Congo, getting drunk, and picking up a girl in a bar, and then, which is how Ed Sheeran would do it.
Yeah, I don't think he could actually write that song because, I don't know, I think if he did it, it would just be like the theme tune to the popular soft drink Ombongo. I can only imagine him writing it in that kind of way. And that song's
I've been drinking in the Congo. That would be amazing. Laura, we've just scored our new number one single. Ombongo, Ombongo, I've been drinking in the Congo with this girl. And then they do the African chant, obviously, because it's ethnic. And that's the noise that you'll have heard over some Fela Kuti type stuff. Because, you know, Africa.
Yes, exactly. Well, there is always the Ghana song on the bonus tracks of the Ed Sheeran album, which I cannot in good conscience recommend that anybody listen to. So that brings us to the end of the second edition of Unbreak My Chart. You can subscribe on iTunes and leave us a review. You can also email us at unbreakmychartpod@gmail.com. You can also leave comments on the SoundCloud, which I think we'll continue to put them up, even though we've got iTunes, and we will respond on there as well. You can reach us both on Twitter. Fraser, what's your Twitter name?
It's @CSI_popmusic.
Mine is @LauraSnapes. Thank you all very much for listening. Join us again next week. We might even have a podcast done in person next week because we're both going to be in the same place at the same time. So you have that to look forward to, and hopefully the further ascent of songs that are not Ed Sheeran and the decline of more Ed Sheeran-related content.
Bye! Thanks for listening.
Bye!